What's up, bootlickers? I haven't seen y'all since camp out. I got something to say, right?
Anarchy! Anarchy! I don't even know what that means, but I love it!
Anarchy is, and always has been, the best way and the only morally sensible way to run the world.
Cool. It's not just cool. It's the intersection of life and politics, activism and action.
And there's only one way to get power. Organize. All the workers together. One big union. And the war the IWW wants you to get into is class war. War against the capitalists.
Come on! It's not criminal to be an individual.
It's not criminal to be an individual.
How could you go to a riot without me? You were supposed to be my riot buddy.
I'm escaping to the one place that hasn't been corrupted by capitalism. Space!
I was a victim too. At least my wife was. She had friends who were socialists.
Oh my God.
Welcome back. This is the Three Left Show, your source, a source for radical left-wing politics, covering socialism, anarchism, deep ecology, and the like, various cool ideas for a better post-capitalist to the present and future. So we're here in our second hour. I'm your host, Dan Platt. With me in the studio is Sage. Taking notes, getting prepared. So the first, we're going to do the lighter first section, going to be lighter and talk about the Vermont gubernatorial race, particularly two candidates that are interesting. One is a trans woman who doesn't identify as a progressive because the progressive agenda to her is just so common sense and what have you that it shouldn't be called so. Which strikes me as a little conceited, but I don't know how I feel about it in totality, depending on it's because of the source. But otherwise, she's a good person. Comes from the private sector, which is interesting that it's the trans woman who would probably make the most waves, is, politically speaking, the most safe. She's probably the safe choice for conservative Democrats. So it's a nice little trick there. one or the other. Are you socially progressive? Or now you don't have to have that false choice there. Now you can be the conservative, deficit-focused Democrat. But I don't know. Most candidates, because we were looking at their websites, and if you actually want to be an informed voter, you look at each candidate's website, it's rare to see a candidate actually go into specifics about their policies. This is usually because most office, like we still think about representation as being, it's a toss-up, and that's kind of why it's frustrating. Are you voting for someone because they have a platform that, and you're voting for a venue of items, things you actually want to happen? Or are you voting for someone based on their personality and their background to do all of the work for you, and who are they going to listen to? Like, what activists they'll listen to, what causes they'll jump on as they come about, and what they're likely to do. So, like, are you voting for that, or are you voting based on almost identity politics, or are you voting for a platform and this person just happens to be representing it at the time? Maybe they're just good at articulating it. That's kind of what Bernie Sanders is about. It was about the platform. It really wasn't about him. But he also had a good, personality that people would enjoy as well. So this is something you wanted to bring up, Sage. So do you have things to say about, what was her name? Hallquist.
Yeah, Christine Hallquist, trans person. And, Ethan Sonneborn is a 14-year-old. As far as I know, I think these are the first candidates in any elections going on to be trans or this young. Ethan Sonneborn, some people are asking, is this even legal? Yes. There's no laws keeping somebody that young from running for governor in Vermont?
There's just a residency requirement.
Yep. Yeah, and, again, no restrictions on, you know, being trans at all. So, yeah, to sum up their policies, let's see, Ethan Sonneborn, he's, they're both kind of run-the-mill progressive politics nowadays, like, you know, Bernie Kratz, he's about...
Right, it's a standard position, at least in Vermont.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah. It's not too surprising for Vermont. Universal health care, raise the minimum wage, tax benefits. He's very interested in keeping Vermont accountable to the Paris Climate Accord. And he got the whole election because he's concerned about youth apathy and low voter participation rates among the youth. He wants to try and change that. And let's see, he actually got, if I'm quoting this right, 7% of the vote.
We have the results.
That right here.
Has it happened yet?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. He also puts LGBT rights on his issues, and
right. That struck you because he put it out as being so commonsensical.
Yeah.
It's such the default.
Yeah, kind of generation shift there.
But isn't it the default for millennials like us?
Yeah. Yeah, it's just become a pretty across-the-board thing.
What's even stronger for them now?
Yeah.
It's really consolidated.
Yeah, LGBT rights, it's just becoming...
It goes into how you shift radical opinions in the law, so that people are, in fact, identifying with movements and positions instead of maybe quietly doing so, or just shifting towards the new moderate position created by radicals, or the new extreme position. Which is that you kind of need people around you to hold those views enough so that it creates a new reality, a new sense of what is safe around you to do. Media and television, especially when, say, radicals and extremists get on TV, people might be initially repulsed and will continue to be repulsed, not identify with radicals. Oh, they're ruining their case. But their ideas are still being taken on. Internalized or considered, and then they won't be accredited later. This is kind of the role of the Green Party as far as the Democrats that run primaries. They take on the language of the Green New Deal, the Keynesian jobs programs for transition. And the Green Party doesn't get any credit, even though we've been pushing Green New Deal as like a phrase for over a decade. And now they're starting to use it. And they won't work with Greens at all. And I have an article, no have time for it, but it's basically someone calling out those who don't want to work for the Greens, and it is with the Greens. We need the coalition build, but you still have a lot of groups and people, including the DSA, that want to have it both ways, that want to say they're an independent party, and they'll support independent candidates, but otherwise it's always Democrats. And they will not even mention the Greens as we might endorse them or we'll consider it. They don't even call them. They don't include them in their debates. It's quite infuriating to me and also a little concerning, frightening of what kind of progress can we make if there are entire organizations, institutions of activists, in the thousands. And they're basically written off because of the brand that they have is damaged. Well, who damaged it? The people you're fighting. We have the same opponents here. So here we have two. The other two are cishet men, I guess. Was it the Halquist article that actually mentioned what they do? And I actually thought what one of them did was actually way more interesting. I guess not. I think they're both Burlington people as well. Both Ethan, the 14-year-old, and Halquist, the trans woman. But, we're talking about this because of their identities. In the Green Party, we had a guy in Florida run for the presidential nomination in 2016, and he was a teenager. He was older, like 17. So, or 16. He still had like a year before he could vote. And there was a lot of support for him as far as like, oh, great, you know, engagement, youth engagement. We do want to lower the voting age to 16. And since then, I've always incorporated in talking about election reforms that we should drop the voting age to 14. Why? Well, consider that we let 16-year-olds drive, operate heavy machinery that can kill people. Now, yes, there's a lot of insurance and restrictions and whatever, but 40 hours of training is all that's needed. And I think you're supposed to get 40 years of training in high school for civics. I know that's not really likely at this particular time, but let's say with lowering the voting age, we actually make civics a priority in school to be funded and actually matter. And at 14, you can work and thus contribute to the economy, and that means paying taxes, on via payroll taxes or whatever. If you can work, I mean, maybe a compromise would be you have to be working to vote, but that's, we don't put that on anyone else. So, and another compromise is to drop it to, at least for local school elections, so that students can vote on the budgets and the school board members of the schools that they're going to. You know, otherwise they're captive. There's no consent. Like, they're going to a school that they have no real say in the policy. And we all know, at least through happenstance anecdote, that they are capable, especially at post-puberty. We're talking about teenagers here. They are capable of being political, organizing, thinking along the terms of their own interests, obviously. And thus they should be able to vote. And if you have a problem about restricting the vote, I mean, you're basically an elitist, anti-populist, and I don't really, the conversation has nowhere to go. Because it comes from an innate, you know, belief system, usually, in how terrible people are, and not how good they could be. And that giving people access to things like the franchise to vote is kind of step one of like all these there's enough uneducated people voting. Well, why don't you vote for more adult education? You know, well, what causes this miseducation? A lot of things that you, hypothetical liberal, don't actually want to address. So, do you have any thoughts to contribute on my little rant there?
Well, yeah, I think the ultimate irony is that Ethan Sonborn can run at 14, but 14-year-olds can't vote in that election. So it's rather absurd.
As far as Vermont's eccentric kind of rules go. And that this is a rule that was created when Vermont was legalized as a state, and it hasn't been changed since. So it kind of goes to that, like, laws that don't sunset.
Yeah.
But should.
Say it's kind of a loophole.
Up to revision and revote every 5 years or 10 years, that we should be able to. I mean, certain things like, say, the Patriot Act need to be renewed. And everyone in Congress votes for it over and over again. And I think in the last round, they just kind of made it permanent and they don't have to renew it again. I watched a video about 9/11 and they mentioned the Patriot Act like in the past tense. Like, as if there was the Patriot Act. I'm like, well, yeah, I guess as an event of it being passed, but I mean, it's still there on the books. It's still affecting how the government treats our prisoners and arrests people. The problem of Guantanamo Bay wasn't solved. It wasn't fixed. It's still there. We're still torturing people. It's brought up and then it's assumed to be fixed because we have responsible people in government until Trump. Now we don't.
I haven't heard about it in a while.
Yeah.
But it is rather weird, though, about the Patriot Act. Like I read lots of recent court cases and all, and arrests and such. And the Patriot Act doesn't seem to be as used as it could be. It grants rights to basically call anybody who threatens any kind of violence against anybody.
Or being affiliated.
Yeah.
Well, it was in 2012, there was the...
It's hardly been used to its full potential. And more often than not, a lot of terrorists and other cases end up just being prosecuted under different laws than the Patriot Act.
I suppose. Well, that's because we have the National Defense Authorization Act, which allows for indefinite detention
of
anyone who falls under the language set by the Patriot Act, which was all you have to do is materially or emotionally support terrorists, whatever that means. Welcome back to the Three Lefts Show. And one of those lefts, as far as types of being left, is socialism. And so we're going to cover, building off of the last hour's topic of responses to climate change, let's talk about a socialist response to climate change. And so this is an essay written by Matthew Huber, a mainstream democratic socialist. Okay, very clear about that. It sadly comes up in one of the... So he has written Five Principles of a Socialist Climate Politics. And this is a powerhouse of an article for me. He hits areas, like these five areas, to really talk about how activists have been dealing, like working as climate activists, and how they, it's kind of a you're doing it wrong, but I mean, the results are there, that the progress has been slow, at least, if there's any progress. When it comes to solar power, for example, it needs to be done with copious incentives and, you know, Keynesianism, state programs. And it's being done through the private sector. So you have companies that are installing more solar capacity, but it's not accessible to everyone. It's very slow. It's growing at like an incremental rate. And it's incrementalism. So, and I'm not a fan of it. It's just so slow. I mean, yes, I'm not going to like, I'm chilly whenever it happens, and there are others that like do that I know. But it's just so little, and it's like too little, too late. And by the time it's like we're going to have the long form change, and we'll have a transformed, you know, energy economy. Yeah, 2050 at least, we'll have half of our economy that will be renewables. All right, when needs to be all of it. And of course, the goal for like serious radicals has always been 2030, but that was back in 2010 and before that. Can we still make that? Well, if we have a big Keynesian program, maybe. But it needed to be started yesterday. So anyway, let's go into the five principles. The first one is that climate change is a class problem. I mentioned this before quickly. It seems obvious enough. Rich people are responsible for causing climate change, and the poorest bear the costs. Droughts, rising seas, and floods. Yet, we are somewhat confused on this issue. The rallying cry of radical climate politics, system change, not climate change, rightly blames the system, as Black Lives Matter will also say we need the system change, or any good group says system change. But how do systems change? While more liberal-minded system change theorists like Gal Afarovitz suggest, we could incrementally move beyond capitalism via a middle path of evolutionary reconstruction, as he puts it. Marx and Engels are quite clear on how system change works. The history, quote, the history of all existing society is a history of class struggles. Too often the notion of system change doesn't emphasize that we are fighting a class of people, a ruling class, rather than a vague, impersonal system. Class struggle entails a politics that directly confronts the interests of the class in power, whether it be with strikes, regulation, or movements to expropriate / take power, property. Just recently, the idea of nationalizing the fossil fuel industry has finally circulated into climate policy discussions. Yeah, there are some people in business politics of system change that has nothing to do with class. As an interesting number of environmental groups are emphasizing, it's system change or bust. From a political standpoint, Something interesting has occurred here. Climate change has made anti-capitalist struggle, for the first time in history, a non-class-based issue. Back to the author. How in the world is anti-capitalism not class-based? We need to go, and that's kind of how it is. It's like it's still not class-based. Like the rhetoric is system change, and it has a capitalist critique. It might even be anti-capitalist. But it kind of assumes no one's in charge. There's no one at the top. There's no one benefiting who has an interest in maintaining climate change. Or they'd rather climate change as an effect of their riches, you know, the billionaires. So skip ahead. We may counter, don't we consumers end up consuming all of the cement, steel, and other products of industrial capital? Well, other industries actually do a lot of the consuming, but carbon footprint ideology has led us to believe that all of our consumption is entirely our own responsibility. Yet, as I have argued, your carbon footprint is not really the problem. Even when you drive a car, the emissions coming out of the tailpipe are not yours alone. Auto, oil, steel, and other companies profit from the production of the car you're driving. For the vast majority of us who lack ownership of the means of production, control over how things are made, our choices are severely constrained. We have to commute to work with cars by necessity. We buy processed food due to exhaustion. We try to navigate our life with a strapped budget and a limited set of for-profit firms who offer us the things we need for sale. In fact, every commodity has users and profiteers along the chain. A socialist climate politics would place the bulk of responsibility on those profiting from production, not simply those fulfilling their needs in an alienated world of consumerism. So going on to number two. So any jumping with thoughts? Number two, climate solutions need to appeal to the material interests of the working class. History shows that overcoming entrenched power requires vast numbers of ordinary people, a mass movement. Now, when I say working class, I do not only mean white male coal miners or factory workers. At the broadest level, we could define the working class as those that must work to survive. As Sarah Jaffe and others have pointed out, the American working class of today is to the large extent female and disproportionately people of color. It includes not only industrial workers, but nurses, teachers, warehousers, and retail. In the United States, there are more people that work at Arby's than in coal mines. Kim Moody roughly estimates that after subtracting the 1% of capitalists who actually direct and control major corporations, managers, and small business owners, the working class constitutes about 63% of the employed population. If you add in the underclass, those that are out of work, disability, it gets to 75%. Moody's first number overlaps with another jarring statistic. The same number, 63% of households, could not afford a simple $500 emergency payment for something like an ER visit or a car breakdown. If climate politics wants to win, we must learn how to better speak to the interests of this 63%. In fact, it is impossible to imagine we are building a democratic movement without doing so. And thus gets into Keynesianism, the democratic program, again, the job guarantee. Housing programs that aim to deliver both efficient weatherized homes and viable, affordable housing that's public. Buildup of green infrastructure, etc., etc. Number three. 333. Climate politics cannot only be... Oh, yeah, and this is something that I haven't actually seen articulated well. Climate politics cannot only be about knowledge and the belief or denial of, quote, the science. It must be about control and power. To deny the science of climate change in 2018 is preposterous. But too often our politics makes the struggle about the knowledge of the science itself. Those who oppose climate action are denialists. A naive version of the story says that we need to simply better communicate the science to the masses. Once they accept it, then we'll be able to enact Keynesianism. But a lot of the denial, and I'm adding this, a lot of the denial is based around a rejection of Keynesianism and state. And state massive state spending. Yet, as Jonathan Smucker argues, right does not equal might. It is not at all clear that if we convince the 47% of the country that questions the truth of climate change, we will also overcome the entrenched power of the fossil fuel industry. Yes, it is awful that the fossil fuel industry funds denialist pseudoscience, but it is more awful that it is still given total freedom to dig up fossil fuels and sell them for a profit. It is ridiculous that an appointed EPA administrator, currently Scott Pruitt, went on television, denied the science of climate change, but it is worse that he took hundreds of thousands of dollars from fossil fuel interests during the campaign, his campaign for Attorney General. One must often wedge their subjective beliefs into ideological frameworks that justify their own power. I would hazard a guess that when Scott Pruitt lays his head on a pillow at night, he knows anthropogenic climate change, meaning man-made climate change, exists. He also knows his power depends upon serving the material interests of the fossil fuel industry, his own wealth. The climate struggle is less about knowledge and more about material struggles. As Principle 2 would suggest, socialist politics will not only mean awakening the working class to the truth, but also convincing them that climate change solutions will improve their lives. Climate change is often presented as an abstract problem. Emissions today are stronger. Emissions today mean stronger storms in the future, or something like that. But to weave this in with unionized green jobs and cleaner and cheaper energy, and more democratic control over life itself, which the current, that's why I'm not totally for like the private expansion of solar power. It lends to scams and leasing and you don't own the means of power production. Someone else will. So, let's see. As Joan Williams put it in her viral piece, post-2016, the working class resents professionals but admires the rich. This is because professional class people, the very scientists, academics, and journalists at the core of the climate coalition, are often the ones telling working class people what to do, and why they're wrong. Telling the 47% of climate deniers that man-made climate change, that they're ill-behaved and ignorant, falls directly into the right-wing populist trap. That is a hoax perpetuated by a liberal elite. Winning the climate struggle will no doubt entail mobilizing masses of people who don't know what 350 refers to, or even how the greenhouse effect works. So don't worry about communicating the science. Communicate the benefits of massive transition investment. What are the goods? Number four is don't tax molecules, but tax the rich. So we kind of mentioned that about carbon taxes are in part regressive. We should just progressively tax the rich. Now, something about democratic socialists is that, like DSA, is they have all the platform of the Keynesianism public programs like free college, single-payer healthcare. It's frightening to me how, I mean, it took a year or two, but now it's only Medicare for all. We don't say single-payer anymore. I guess it wasn't a winning name for the policy. But to me, it doesn't matter what it's called. It's once you tell people what it is, they're for it. It's not a problem what it's called. But I suppose if you're just going to ad nauseum say what the policy is, Medicaid for all. I mean, I don't know. I just don't like the sound of it. It is what it is. But maybe because it's just making it about expanding an existing program, it just makes it feel less radical to me. Maybe because it is. It isn't socialized medicine. And that's the kind of thing, like, oh no, it's not actual socialization. We're just using the public sector to do things the private sector can't do, which is deliver affordable health care. Right? But then the next step is, well, why don't we do it even better and socialize it? But you got to do what's safe and acceptable. And people love Medicare, so expanding that or making it for all is more acceptable. But, you know, where's the risk, right? And number five, to finish up here, is that climate change requires planetary solidarity. The Workers of the World Unite slogans of past socialist movements. We have the slogans, but we do, in fact, need to reject the elitist UN bodies that keep putting the onus on, well, how are these third world countries going to develop in a sustainable manner? But never have the actual clout, power, or teeth to penalize the big polluters like the Pentagon and our empire and, of course, the mega corporations. The goal is to democratize control over providing for our basic needs. As Sean Gerd recently put it, democratic socialism at its core, and this is where it becomes like the democratic socialist pitch, at its core is about deepening democracy where it exists and introducing democracy where it is absent. Today, much of what we need to survive is produced by firms, private governments that only seek profit. But as explained above, democracy also means appealing to the needs of a mass majority of people who crave a decent, secure, and comfortable life. Socialism, capital S, would gear the entire economy towards care and the needs of the many against the profits of a few. So how do you feel about those five principles? I think I'll review them. One is that it's a class problem, class struggle. Two, that thus you need to, if you're going to be a climate activist, you know, care about climate, the solutions need to appeal to a majority of people, and thus what they actually want to have. It's easy to talk in terms of using less energy if you're in the middle class and use more than everyone else does, right? To talk in terms of using less energy to someone who's already deprived.
Yeah, if you're using a minimum amount of energy.
Then of course they're turned off. Number three is that, you know, it's about control and power, not just about knowledge. Obviously, money will trump in terms of what people believe, because survival always comes first, and having the most. We need to use progressive taxation instead of regressive taxation. So even, you know, taxing carbon is a failure. It's a failure, and it's also a Band-Aid. And number five is that we need global solidarity. All the people who are affected worse than us, and that also taking, you know, it needs to be a global revolution, not socialism in one country, which is Stalinism. Yeah, actually,
I mean, we're not following all these things in the U.S. You still got China pumping out carbon emissions like crazy. I mean, China's like the equivalent of multiple countries of carbon emission. So it has to be looked at simultaneously, a small and a big picture. But there's not a lot of that sort of strategization going on.
Okay. So,
not enough anyways.
Didn't go into the super radical solutions there, but we ran the gamut, gamut, which I actually looked up where the source of where that word comes from, because I use it enough. It's a musical scale. It comes from music. Mm-hmm. It's a scale of going up and down the notes. So all the notes. And so now I'm gonna see if I can make this a regular section of the show, or a semi-regular section. Facebook rants where people type in a mini essay, rant, multiple paragraphs in Facebook or social media platform. I kind of have my own law of Facebook, which is the more paragraphs someone writes in a discussion, the more they're trying to shout people down. Because they're like just overwhelming the conversation. And it's also kind of similar to a debate tactic of you just throw out so much bull crap that your opponent can't address all of it. And then you get to say, well, you didn't address this point. Well, I could only address 3 of the 7 lies you told. And this is how many politicians operate.
Have you ever heard of neo-reactionaries at all? People who are saying, oh, we got to go back to kings and queens and feudal times.
Monarchists.
Yeah. They love using that tactic. Almost all their stuff is gigantic walls of text.
Walls of text.
And if you try and debate them on it, then they can always say, like, oh, well, you read the whole thing. Oh, you aren't familiar with this, that, the other thing, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, it's an overwhelming wall of text, and thus you're shutting the conversation down. But if you start the thread with this, and then everything after that is a free-flowing, good faith conversation, that's a little different. So here I'm going to read from Grace Bluegreen, lifelong climate activist or environmentalist that I know here in Albany, and she's a wonderful woman. Bit on the crunchy side, real aging hippie here. So I'll start. This is a rant I carry with me, and I hope you find it useful. Enviros, unite. We have nothing to lose but our chains. This is an old axiom of radical environmental action. Give me 5 good rednecks, and I'll shut the operation down. Give me 100 college-educated middle-class environmentalists, and we'll have meetings for the next 10 years. That's partly true. The thing we need to understand about the folks who labor with their hands do not define themselves by what they can afford to consume and are blissfully free of sectarian arguments, is that they are freed up to feel powerfully drawn to defending the land, the community, and their own sense of empowerment and dignity. Often they know the land like the back of their hands and have copious observations about animal and plant behavior. Sometimes they rely on deer and fish as an expensive protein sources. They hunt. Often, they know how to keep their ancient car on the road, born to cover just a little more ground, rather than invest all those carbon emissions into making a new one. Wink, wink, electric and hybrid cars. Wink is that by me. When we wave around our degrees in climate communications and our ability to take vacations that require plane travel and exhibit exorbitant interests in other people's food choices at their local diner or fast food joint or in their homes, we distance ourselves from the best sources of knowledge and support, our rednecks, our native nations, and our brave inner-city residents who know how to milk a dime, know how to make do with less, know what makes industry go, and have hands-on skills that can function to help dying industry survive or help us survive the inevitable industrial collapse. The thing about classism in the movement is that it is disingenuous, unconscious, not even recognized as having occurred. When we take the summer off to do good and advertise how good we are that we are doing good, we may be rubbing salt in the wounds of the community resident who is working 2 jobs and still trying to shut down the plant that will poison her family. When we are gleeful over the Prius, Tesla, or solar system we just bought, we may be making the person who is barely hanging in there on their family's farm under the weight of taxes feel uncomfortable about the pickup they drive. It takes some friendliness and a little bit of a filter to do good work with the people most at risk, and the people who are going to win this one in the end. Carry on, but do so with a welcoming presence. If someone is new to the movement, take them out to that diner and talk to them about their family and their concerns. Sit next to them at the meeting and explain all the subtext. And for God's sakes, tell them the whole pronoun thing is optional. They are wanted, needed, and valued whenever they can join their voices with the lawyers, vacation takers, college kids, doctors, scientists, faith leaders, career environmentalists, board of directors of nonprofits, and all the other whose true role is to serve the needs of all the endangered species and all the endangered humans who have so much to teach us all if we would only shut up and listen. I've been an environmentalist as a runaway teen, college student, an indigent single mom, and an unemployed person with a disability, and currently a privileged government bureaucrat. The way we treat each other is imbued with our assumptions about class, background, competence, and appropriateness. It's time to put some of those assumptions on the back burner and be open to one another. That is a rant for solidarity. Sage?
Yeah, some really humanist stuff, you know, and it comes down to it. They're stuck on the same planet here as we are, and they're in the same boat, whether they realize it or not. And, yeah, those are people we got to work with when all is done and done.
I noticed in college, it was something that really concerned me in the liberal movements I was just opposed to. And I did not like any of the rhetoric that seemed to assume that, like, all of our opponents can just be gotten rid of. It's odd that, you know, they're nonviolent and what have you, but it's just kind of assumed that, like, we'll change the laws and the rest of the people we disagree with will just have to do as they're told. Now, this might be an ingrained assumption that because so many Americans respect the authority of the state so much that, let's say, when gay marriage is legalized, you know, yes, the Christian movement against gay marriage is, you know, almost neutralized, but they're not gone. But it's just kind of like, oh, with social progress, they'll be dragged along, and we just have to wait for them to die. And I, especially when we're actually in a real crisis, and me and my friends are struggling and poor, while the liberal who talks this way is retired, you know, they had a career their whole life, or they're in a career that's safe. You know, I always get a little indignant at them on the side about their point of view.
Yeah, rightly so.
That they can wait it out. That it's like, oh yeah, we'll just have to wait them out, and the oldest evangelicals will die off, and because the younger generations are more secular / more environmentalist, more queer, or queer friendly. But there are people suffering that should not have to wait decades and decades, right? And that's kind of why the revolutionary impulse to change things quickly comes in. We are in a deep crisis that is going to affect more and more people and make things more and more worse for those that are already on the bottom. And so the history rhyming, you know, we'll hit that wall where just like there's the underclass can't take it anymore. Because there's scary trends in our own city, as it might be yours.
It's really a kind of big dividing line, I suppose, between, you know, radicals and other people is, how severe do we think the situation is? Grave situations require grave measures.
As long as your social security check is still coming in, how grave are the... is the situation.
Yeah, it's tougher to convince somebody in the cushy position that the situation is that grave.
Like, there's that, the new Kaepernick Nike memes of, you know, what are you willing to sacrifice? Or, you know, sacrifice comes this and that. You know, what's the middle class willing to sacrifice? Now, they've sacrificed for the growth of capitalism or its existence post 08, they've sacrificed their position as the middle class. You know, it's destroyed now. They're all basically above the poverty line. They've sacrificed so we can have billionaires so Bezos can have $600 billion or whatever he has. So we can have more billionaires. They've sacrificed for them, or rather for the system. Can we now sacrifice for the good of many instead of the few. Because the sacrificing for the good of the few has been kind of the autopilot of the American political system. To have something else, that's up to us. Yeah, that's the feeling. So, thank you for joining us here at the Three Left Show. I'll go through the housekeeping. We are on social media, Twitter, Facebook, not yet Instagram, because this is a podcast and I don't take that many pictures in the first place. But I know that there were many young people that use, there were people that use Instagram and nothing else. Then there is, you can find this show on all the major podcast apps, Stitcher, Google Play, although I looked for it and I didn't find it, but it says my account's active. But definitely iTunes, and anywhere that iTunes is uploaded, I think I'm on Podcast Addict and something else. So I'm engaged in expanding the number of options for that. Stitcher, not yet on YouTube, but I'm working there. But more support makes me confident that I should be doing that, instead of just focusing on getting a new job or another job. That's kind of what I'm focused on now as a individual, in self-care mode, I would say. Next is we have a Patreon page. If you'd like to support the show materially, help make get these better mics, help the station, and just generally put me on a better footing to do put more effort into the show. Otherwise, it will stay a hobby. Then, yeah, so there's more to add, I suppose. Yes, just general word of mouth. If this is the first time you listen to the show, or multiple times, please tell others about it. Bring it up in conversation. Hey, you listen to any podcasts? What podcasts do you listen to? I just found this brand new one. Obviously, it happens organically, happens to me all the time. And now I can say myself, I have my own podcast. but obviously, when you find a podcast you like and you like what it's doing, you want to share it, obviously. And so I shouldn't really have to remind anyone, but I'm going to say it anyway.
Yeah, no one's that fair. Yeah, where do you get your news from? Oh, I get my news from Three Lefts.
Yeah. Or my analysis. You know, I heard this funky opinion. So, thank you for joining us. Let me, can you play this? Can you vamp for a moment, Sage?
Ooh. Oh, what the hell? I guess, yeah, I'll reiterate, you know, the same point I've made at least once or twice throughout the show that, yeah, we have to connect for people. How is climate change and ecological destruction hitting them in the wallet? You know, we live in a country, it's all about me, and you gotta show the me people, you know, how they're being affected, and start from, you know, the economic points, and then draw back from there how, you know, the environment and these bigger issues are affecting that. Don't start from, you know, an environmental or ecological issue and then get back to them and their wallet, and try and start from them and work outwards.
How can I make this, yeah, how to make this democratic socialist agenda ecological rather than how do I make the ecological socialist? But anyway, or you just do it both at the same time, and that's eco-socialism, and that's what I and the Green Party are, so we're running on that. So thank you for joining us. This has been Three Left Show here in Albany, New York. Thank you very much. Solidarity to all. You beautiful people. Be well. Don't try to take this from me. Don't try to take this from me.